I'm Owen.
And I'm Chris.
And this is the Dead Wargamer Society.
Hey, everybody. So, welcome back. We are going to be discussing some Clan War today, but before we get along to that, Owen, what have you been up to hobby-wise?
This and that. I've painted 500 points of Conquest, The Last Argument of Kings. I actually had my first full game yesterday, so that was interesting. It was fun. Really nice to be able to get back to the game store and play games in person. You know, still wear a mask and everything, but we're moving back towards being closer to normal. Other than that, I've got some Relic Blade that I need to finalize for the next month or so, and then it's probably going to be Conquest on my table for a bit after that, and maybe sneaking in some Dark Age in advance of some conventions coming down the pipe. But how about you?
Yeah, I actually also got a game in yesterday, which was pretty neat. I played some Aristea. Again, you know, super good to get models on the table. I've been working on polishing off the last of the Relic Blade stuff that I had from the most recent Kickstarter, which I'm excited to finish up. I've also been assembling two commissions that I got in kind of back to back, which is really exciting because it's both are things that I haven't really worked on before. One is two boxes for Warcaster, which is fun, you know, going back, the casts and the models are very nostalgic for me of Mark II War Machine. You know, like there's a lot in there where it's like, oh, huh, yeah, like I remember this is what Jax and, you know, infantry like felt like. A lot of it is very similar weight and stuff. They're prettier. There's less flash, but like it's that same kind of feel. And then the other thing was a full Cursed City box. So I got that all assembled, which is, even though it claims to be push fit, not quite. Like, I guess, you know, like if you want to look at it wrong and feel certain things fall apart, it might be. But again, something that's super exciting. It should be a lot of fun to paint.
That was a pregnant fun.
Well, because it's like looking at certain things, it's like, man, you know, I don't really get a chance to paint a lot of the undead stuff, and some of the undead stuff, you know, just like comparing it to where the 90s was, like I'm like, I remember the old skeleton armies and it just being like, yeah, here's a skeleton like you'd see in your science class with like a sword. New ones, you know, it's full, you know, has plate armor, swords, like cloak. And just like, you know, some cool stuff. The main villain characters have a lot of cool cinematic feel to them, without going overboard. Like there's a good amount of detail for me. The characters are a little intimidating for what I would typically like just pull off in a thing. Because there are so many like itty bitty, like just little details, some of which may be slightly unnecessary. You know, it's like there's, you know, it's like when you're looking at it, it's like, man, there are X amount of rivets and clasps and this. It's like super steampunky things. This is like, man.
Time out. Are you saying that Games Workshop's recent releases might be a little too busy? I am shocked. The first time I'm hearing this.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, for me, it's a sweet spot. You know, certain things have not quite the amount of detail that you want to put into it. And it can be difficult to make them stand out without like doing like little extra tricks and adding things that aren't really there. And other models take it a little bit too far with just like, man, like, why does this model even have this? Like, you know, like I just remember like the first time I experienced that, like at the time, which now is like super tame in comparison, was like the Trollkin fell blades.
Oh, yeah.
Like, putting together troll stuff. I'm like, man, like, why does this guy have like two cups, three pouches, like a leg of ham for some reason? Like,
it's all about competing with Rackham. When they put out those behemoth orcs, they threw down. I mean, those things have literally a pantry. I'm pretty sure a kitchen sink. There's random birds. So like that was a challenge. Sculptors since have felt it necessary to include whatever they can find in their pantries on the back of models. Either that, or I just don't know the right people. And apparently, whoever sculpts just carries around the entirety of their house on their backpack. So who knows?
Yeah, that's been a lot of what I've been working on. That will most likely be what's on my table for the course of the next month. between those two things, that is, it's going to get boring for people over the next couple of podcasts. Like, what are you working on? Oh man, Curse City, not as excited anymore.
What I'm hearing is we're going to have that much more time to put out awesome content about the games we talk about. But you mentioned the 90s earlier, so let's talk about another game from the 90s. You mentioned it at the top, Chris, Clan War by AEG. Clan War is based upon a property called Legends of the Five Rings. Is that something you've got a lot of familiarity with?
Yes. Yeah. Legend of the Five Rings, I definitely have more experience with than Clan War. And I think that's definitely true for the majority of the population. Kind of looking into it, I think most people who are familiar with Legend of the Five Rings, it's most likely going to be the card game.
Yep.
One version or another. You know, if you're younger, you might have been introduced with the newest living card game that's come out. If you're a little bit older, like we are, man, like I remember Legend of the Five Rings actually before the company got sued by the Olympics. So, because it used to like, and they had to change the card backs, like so many
Yep.
things happened. They have, you know, again, it goes to like a lot of the way the 90s was, where it wasn't enough to put out a game. You wanted an entire universe. And we've kind of explored that a little bit with like BattleTech and GW Games and Warzone, where, you know, it's not just like, here's this game that's on the table. Legend of the Five Rings was a super interesting thing because they did have books, which were actually solid books. Like I had reread them multiple times as a kid. There was the, you know, in the beginning of the internet stuff, there was a lot of forums out there with people discussing, and they had three different game systems, all of which advanced the storyline depending on larger event outcomes, which was pretty cool. There was a collectible card game, which was the most popular game. There was a role-playing game, and there was Clan War, which was the miniatures game. Unfortunately, what had kind of sort of happened is as time went on, because the card game was more popular, had more events, the card game storyline advanced way quicker than the storyline in like the minis game, and things started to kind of fall out of sync a little bit. And around that time, the Olympics sued the company because of their use of five king rings in the logo, which I remember at the time was just super hilarious for a lot of people. Probably not the company, but like all I remember is like, you know, like going online and people were like dumping at the time, like, oh, you know, like, well, what casting things would you see for characters in this? And people were throwing up jokes like, yeah, you know, until they get sued, you know, by the Olympics and can't release the movie for, you know, the Olympics claiming copyright over anything that has people running. Like, you know, and so they advanced the storyline. They redesigned their card backs for the card game, which now had like almost more discs rather than rings. And shortly after, I think that's that, you know, like the card game, it was kind of its like last legs kind of thing. The card game really didn't survive long past that.
So, I was actually going to step in and
Yeah.
just note one thing. I actually know people that played L5R, the collectible game, and I wouldn't say the game died after the Olympics thing. It definitely was in production through the 2010s, and it had been continuously. I think the Olympics thing messed with Hasbro because Wizards had actually picked up the game. If you notice on the back of a lot of your Clan World rule books, you'll see licensed by Wizards of the Coast. So I know there was some messiness there. I remember at the time in like the late 90s, there was a lot more popularity for Clan War, and I think the Olympics slowed it down enough that it kind of knocked it out of contention, if it ever really had been in contention with something like a Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, like, I always knew Magic was dominating,
Oh, yeah.
like, pretty heavy. I mean, also, I mean, like, not to go too far off into the card game stuff, but that was the period where there was a lot of card games.
Yes, yes, there were.
Because, like, I remember going to the store, and I mean, like, yeah, still, you know, the majority of a lot of local game stores are making the majority of their money on card games, but now it's where it used to be, like, yeah, there's a lot of Magic. It's like, man, like it used to be such a variety of stuff, with Magic being the biggest seller, but like outside of Magic, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, it was, you know, Magic. There was two or three different Star Wars games. There was a Star Trek game.
Lord of the Rings.
There was a Lord of the Rings. Yeah, there was a BattleTech game at some point. There was the sister game to Legend of the Five Rings, which is like Legend of the Burning Sands, which
Yep.
was more of like a Arabian kind of feel to it.
I don't want to get too far down that tangent before circling back to say it's the world of Legend of the Five Rings, or we'll just call it L5R for short, because that's how we actually would talk about it. Do you want to give people like a quick and dirty overview of what the game world of L5R looks like?
Yeah, so essentially you're looking at a fantasy version of Japan. So the predominant warrior is a samurai. Ninjas are kind of a thing. There's also dragons and magic, but a lot of the classic historical Japanese influences kind of shine through, both in their folklore, the weaponry, the honor system, diplomacy, and you have an emperor sitting on the throne. You have a number of clans, depending on really who you talk to. For the major houses, you're generally looking between 7 to 8,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of being in contention. Part of that, you know, has to do with generally the timeline that you're looking at, because the game kind of stretches over a while. Mm-hmm. Clan War predominantly takes place in the Clan War period, where a lot of the clans are warring with each other, primarily after the emperor gets assassinated and his very young heir kind of ascends to the throne. So just looking at the clans, you have the Scorpion Clan, which are ninjas, dishonor, and subterfuge. Essentially, all of them wear masks. They're all keeping their intentions hidden. They had the biggest ninja population, lots of underhanded, like, dirty things going on, but they were considered to be the underhand of the emperor, where if the emperor needed something done in a more, let's say, CIA kind of special ops kind of thing, that's who he would be sending to do his will. Looking at the other hands of the emperor, on the left hand of the emperor, you had the Crane Clan, who were all about the honor. Everything about the honor. It was all the diplomacy, arts, fine poetry, all of the kind of fancy court type things, and looking at even warfare as an art. They were famous for their duelists in the game setting, and they had very powerful archers as well. So anything that could kind of be put on display and viewed as almost like entertainment, but was also military, were things that they succeeded at. The Lion Clan was the right hand of the emperor, which was his primary military force, where this was the, you know, hardcore trained samurais. The Lion Clan most likely looked the most like a traditional Japanese army, focusing primarily on swordsmen, spearmen, with some archers. To be completely honest, I usually found the Lion Clan the most boring out of the clans that were available, because they didn't have a lot of these other things going on.
They had some interesting stuff. The major houses tended to be run by women. They had a lot of lady samurai. I mean, the game in general had a more egalitarian split between men and women in the armed forces than you might have expected if this was truly a more historical game. So the Lion tended to skew ladies. They had, you know, packs of battle lions or whatever the heck they're called. So, but yeah, they were, you know, we do army the best of anyone. We're going to general at you sort of faction.
Moving along with the military factions, you also have the Crab Clan. Crab Clan were pretty interesting in that while they were a heavy military clan, they used a lot of weapons that were not swords. They had warhammers and kanobos and tetsubos, all of these like cool heavy crushing weapons. They used siege weapons. It was the only clan that used shields as part of their warfare, which was pretty neat. And when it came down to it, the reason for that was that they were the ones who were guarding the wall, which is on the far south of this empire, which was preventing the evil from spreading forward. So it's kind of like a southern version of the Night's Watch.
Basically.
And yeah, and basically, you know, they were very undiplomatic. They were considered to be rude. They had like the best engineers. There was just a lot of like little interesting things about how different they were. And they generally stayed removed from a lot of the clan politics. You know, occasionally they had some disagreements with the Crane Clan, and there was a little bit of feuding over, you know, some of the minor clans, but generally the majority of their focus was, whether dishonorable or not, what matters the most is that I win this conflict, because if we fail, the entire like empire is done.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be oni and goblins just running through, and they were pretty neat for that. To go a little bit more north, you get into the Phoenix Clan, who was all about the magic. They had a lot of, when you look at the magic in L5R, it's primarily based around five elements. You know, you had your fire, water, earth, air, and the void. So they were dedicated to this, and it's one of the only clans where the warriors aren't actually really the head of the clan, but it's the Sujina, or their magicians and wizards, that are really leading the clan. And they had a council of five, which was each one of the best practitioners of their respective element was on this council, which led to it being just very, very, very interesting, especially for their story. Their one book essentially has the Earth Master travel down into the Shadowlands, and the way that he looks at things and the way he, you know, the way they describe how magic ebbs and flows and the connection to the element actually powering you was a very just interesting concept at the time. They do have a warrior cast as well, but they're not as necessarily well respected as the warrior classes and a few of the other clans. All the way at the top, you have the Unicorn. And the Unicorn were interesting because there was a long period of time where they left. They just completely left the Empire and traveled across the Burning Sands, which is the big desert that's above the Empire. And all of a sudden, you know, like, they come back and they have these gigantic, gigantic war horses that are way bigger than, you know, make, you know, basically makes the all the other horses that are in the Empire look kind of like, you know, somewhere more dog sized. Like, these are like gigantic war beasts. And they come back. And again, it's another clan that's kind of viewed to be not really the most honorable, not really, you know, the most behaved, because they picked up habits. And you can see a lot of the other Asian influences on it. They have like a lot of Mongol influences. They have a lot of Chinese influences, especially in like the weaponry that they carry sometimes. You know, in the story, there's a whole big thing about like, oh man, you know, those unicorns, you know, they're just so uncouth and vulgar. You know, they eat meat. It's a lot of things like that, but yeah, you're essentially looking at the horse masters. Like, if you wanted to play a cavalry game, Unicorn is what you're looking at. The Dragon Clan, which is would we really be the last of like the official clans, or the clans that were started in the founding of the Empire. We're going to have a little bit of a spoiler alert here, which is the dragon themselves were very just, nobody knew what was going on with them. They're very enigmatic, like, oh yeah, they just live up in the mountains. They practice this weird kind of dueling where they use two swords instead of one. They have these monks with tattoos, and the tattoos create magic. People would have like a fire-breathing dragon on their chest and be able to breathe fire using the tattoos. They would have like a tornado and be able to like fling themselves in the air, you know, and nobody really knew how this worked. Their leader, Togashi Yukuni, always got described, you know, for a while as just, man, he's this huge dude. Like, he's this huge dude. His skin kind of shines a little bit like that, but nobody knew how long he really lived for. Like, he seemed to be around forever, but he was super heavily muscled. Like, it was like super weird until all of a sudden, you basically find out that he's the last of the gods that had originally descended to form this empire. And that while all of the other gods had eventually moved on and returned to like the heavens or left the plane, he decided to stay behind to watch humanity and disguised himself as a human so that when the Shadowlands eventually invaded, when their, you know, demonic brother, the eighth god who tried to just basically destroy the world, came up, that he would be able to ensure that humanity won. And that all of those tattoos, they're magical because they're inked with a mixture of ink and dragon blood. For me at the time, you know, especially considering that, like, as I'm reading a lot of it, I mean, I'm like 10 years old. This is amazing. Like, this is so cool. Like, oh man, like, I want to get tattooed with dragon's blood. It's gonna be great. You know, in terms of how that played on the table, you know, it was really the jack of all trades kind of faction, where they had interesting magic. It wasn't quite as good as the Phoenix, but it was pretty cool. You know, they had good duelists. They weren't quite as good as the Crane, but they were pretty good. Then they had Togashi Yukuni, who you could put on the table in his human form, and then in the game you could actually transform him into a Earth Dragon, so he could transform into a dragon on the table. That, you know, like, there's a lot of other minor clans. Eventually, later on, like, especially in the CCG, there were development of a lot of clans, like the Kitsune and Spider Clan and things like that. The Monkey Clan was a thing that never really came out in Clan War, But the one that really did come out was the Mantis Clan, which is essentially there's a bunch of small little islands that are primarily populated by sailors and people who are trading. It is a great place for like riches. There's all these pearl places you can dive and just scoop up some pearls, trade in fine silk, everything else. And they're primarily a merchant clan, which was led by, you know, another just notable warrior in Yorimoto. There's this big epic war surrounding the palace during the clan war. And a lot of the clans are working together to try and remove Fu Leng, basically the devil, from being the emperor. And Yorimoto comes with all the boats, all of these merchants, and all these like soldiers from the sea. So very much like just pirate troops who are all just minor houses at this point, and basically puts out demand. All these other armies are like, oh, this is great. You know, we have reinforcements. We're going to do amazing. You know, like, so thanks for joining. And he's like, nope. When we take this over, you agree that we're a major clan, or I'm going to take my boats and go home. And there's this like beautiful scene, because it was written at least like twice. It was in the rule book, it was also in, you know, the book itself, which went a little bit more into detail. And it was just like, really? Like, you would watch the entire empire burn. You know, if we don't tell you, you can be like a major house. You know, essentially the first house that was founded not by a god, but by a person. And it's like, yep, like, I don't care if the empire burns, we're across the water. Like, and it was just so pragmatic. Just like, nope, like, this is what I want. You know, I'm in a position of power. Like, you're not going to win if I'm not here. And if I'm here, you're going to give me what I want out of this, which is all of the honor, you know. Did they agreed? And from then on, the Mantis was a clan. Moving along, there's essentially just one additional faction there, which is the Shadowlands, which again, you know, the overarching kind of short timeline here to get to Clan War is that at some point in the past, 8 children of the gods, I should say, children of the sun and the moon, fell to the earth, and 7 of them were okay. One of them fell far to the south and ended up kind of sort of crippled, half alive, half dead, and festered. And as his festering kind of spread throughout the lands, which is usually referred to like as the taint, it created a lot of things. So Oni, you had a lot of like the big demons, smaller demons. You had a goblin race. And you also had one of my favorites from that area was the Nezumi, which were rat people. Like, but it was always shown that the rat people, as opposed to like Skaven from GW, weren't necessarily evil. You know, they were just kind of trying to live out their existence. But because they were south of the wall, all of the clans kind of just viewed them as evil and persecuted them for it. It was an interesting kind of like moral thing that was going on, but
not the crab.
not the crab. Crab sometimes, you know, we're again. Crab, all that matters is we win. Not, you know, not if it's honorable. Like, yeah, you know, I'll share a battlefield with a rat. Like, you know, it's cool.
The only other faction that's in the game warrants a quick reference is the Naga, who are, again, it's showing more the pan-Asian influence. Yeah, you know, Indian snake people, but they're now bushis and samurais too sometime. They're woken up, they were the original good guys fighting the Shadowland. Now they're annoyed other people are on their lawn or something. I don't know. In case you can't tell, and I'll let Chris pipe in a second, I came to L5R pretty late. I was aware of the card game as a kid, but as Chris mentioned, the 90s was just ruddy with CCGs. It wasn't quite as bad as Pogs, but it was up there.
It was the new Pogs.
Pretty much. The podcast Thaco from the 2010 timeframe is something I listened to a lot in grad school, and they spoke very highly of L5R. I'm not even a role player, but it was a fawning enough endorsement that I went out and picked up the 4th edition rulebook. I really like it, and I say that as someone that is not a big fan of Japanese-inspired media from Western creators. I don't own a fedora or a trilby, nor a katana. You can probably infer from that I'm not a big anime fan. But I thought this was a really interesting concept. It did well diving in beyond kind of the superficial stuff I was expecting. I think the best overview I can give of it is it's Game of Thrones in feudal Japan with a very different culture, and they do a really good job fleshing out the uniqueness of that culture.
All of the above. I mean, I think with the Naga, you kind of hit on it. Essentially, it was, you know, ancient fighting the evil in the land. And then for whatever reason, and they never really deeply went into it, they basically entered hibernation.
Mm-hmm.
And they entered hibernation in like uninhabited areas. So they were like deep in the forest, and they had a couple that, you know, initially were kind of left awake, but like there was no integration with the actual society. I would say the closest thing, even though it's a completely different scale of things that I can bring up, is it was very much like Ent culture, where nobody really knew that the Ents existed in the forest, but because if you tried to go into the forest, it didn't matter who you were, they just killed you. You know, they slept for, you know, I think it was like 1,000 years. It was something bananas. Like, they were asleep for forever. So, like, the technological advancement of, like, oh, we have, like, swords and bows now, you know, like, became a, oh, like, damn, the you know, like, the last time we saw them, these were basically monkeys. Like, you know, like, this is an entirely different thing. They had a lot of really, really cool stuff going on. Do you remember the one thing that like threw me, especially because, again, like looking at this through the eyes of like a kid, where that all of their models were effectively cavalry models?
Yep.
Because of their tails, which made the army like double the cost of any of the other armies. You know, it's kind of like looking same as like the dragons. Like, I remember like looking at the dragons and it being a $40 for a dragon, be like, oh my god, like who could possibly afford that? Like, who would pay $40 for a single model? Like, what's going on?
Now, excuse me, I need to go fill up my gas tank for $7.35 and buy a pizza for $3 because 1990 money. No, I
also, there wasn't anything really that big back then and stuff like that. But yeah, I think, and this is interesting because, you know, for a lot of game stuff that we've talked about before in our episodes, it's kind of been the reverse of like, Owen got to experience, you know, AT-43. He actually played it multiple times. He owned the models, this and that. Like me, I found out about it, you know, like a month, 2 months, 3 months, maybe before we did the episode. O5R was huge for me. And I think a lot of that too is that we grew up in the time period where it was not cool to be a nerd. Like, it was, you know, like liking Star Wars was not seen as like as a good thing. And I was always like huge into it. And so it was always kind of just like randomly coming across stuff. I honestly don't even remember what first brought me to L5R. Like, I think I might have been in the card store, you know, because I had like two friends who I could play Magic with. Like, and it was just like, oh, like, here's this game that has, it's a two-player starter. I think it might have been Lion Clan versus Unicorn. But yeah, so, you know, I got into the card game, and man, like, the art was so cool for the time, like, especially compared to, like, a lot of the Magic cards that was out there. Like, just the way the card was laid out. And also that there were different victory conditions. There was a lot of really cool things about the card game that were very different from a lot of the other games at the time. And then finding out that there was all of this other universe behind it, it definitely became, like, one of my, like, first real, like, nerd fandoms outside of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was diving deep into the books as a kid, and it kind of introduced me to all these things that Owen isn't big into, you know, like, so, like, yeah, I like my anime, you know. I do own a katana. I mean, shit, like, I tried sushi because of, like, L5R. Like, I was just like, oh man, like, they're eating this stuff in the book, this sounds like a good plan. You know, unfortunately, I tried sushi then for the first time, like, when I was 12, and didn't really appreciate it the first time, but I was like, I'm gonna like make this work. And I remember just, like, my younger brother and sister being like, what's wrong with you? Like, why would you eat this? And just had, like, noodles. I'm like, no, like, this is great. And then, you that first bite was just like, oh, I might have made a mistake. But,
it could have been worse. It could have been Pocky.
Yeah, I love all that stuff now, too. But, yeah, so essentially, you know, like, all of these things, like, it really opened up to me. It opened me up to an entirely different culture, which is impressive talking about, like, a game that's made out of cardboard. You know, like, you know, and a whole bunch of different things that, you know, like, has continued through a lot of my life. Eventually, like, I stumbled into Clan War because, long story short, was that, you know, Mage Knight was my trip into minis.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had some 40K, and then just by, like, chance, of course, beginning of the internet, stumbled across that, oh man, there's a game that's like 40K, except it's with L5R, and I was blown away. I was just like, oh my god, this is gonna be, like, the greatest thing ever. You know, at the time, especially as, like, a kid, it was a lot for me to really absorb. I don't think I had an appreciation for certain things that were going on. it's a little bit harder for me with all of the things that L5R has kind of opened me up to and experienced, like, to filter out some of that nostalgia and, like, look at this in a more objective lens because it's so big. It's so awesome.
I think it's good, though, that one of us is more familiar and has that nostalgia with it. One of us, me, is coming to this a bit more fresh. I think it's also good, though, that we're both fans of the L5R, Rokugan, whatever you want to call it, setting. Because, you know, I don't think you can really divorce that from the game for reasons I'll get into in a little bit. But let's actually pivot over to talking about Clan War itself. So I'll give a quick wiki-style description. Clan War was a mass battle rank-and-file war game set in a feudal Japan-influenced setting designed by AEG. The game was designed by Ken Carpenter and initially published in 1998. The game was notable for its use of tactics cards to influence the game. Clan War stopped receiving support from AEG in the early 2000s, shortly after the publication of the Daimyo edition of the rules. The game requires somewhere between approximately 70 and 128mm miniatures, uses D10s, and is played on either a 4-foot by 6-foot or a 4-foot by 8-foot table. So, Chris, do you want to give people kind of like, in your opinion, the big rules, highlights, or maybe the special points of Clan War?
Yeah, we could do that. Great hit on the table size and the dice, and the fact that it used a very large amount of models, especially, you know, like it didn't seem like a lot then, but now that we're talking about, you know, like playing games like Relic Blade with 3 models, it's like, man, how is that a thing before dipping and like null oil? So the game was kind of interesting at the time in that it used a tactic card deck, which had very similar to like collectible card game wording on the cards. And the tactics were very integral to the way that your army would play. If you didn't know what you're doing with your cards, you most likely would lose the game very easily. Yeah, you had to have a good idea of, you know, the tactic cards that worked, the magic and the way that that worked, as well as the shift. Sometimes, like, I think it was weather conditions that would happen because of like some of like the tactics and things like that that would dramatically affect how certain of your units could operate and work. At the time, I felt like it was the first game to use it because it was the first time I was exposed to it, but I've been informed that that's not entirely true.
Yeah, I would just say before anyone starts yelling at us on our Discord or on Facebook, we're aware that there were implementations to some extent in Warhammer Fantasy. I think Epic 40K is probably the biggest GW game to use them, but those tended to be things like each player would have a deck of cards and one card could let you, I don't know, reroll a missed attack. The extent, the legalistic wording on these, I think really leveraged AEG's experience in CCGs well. The timing triggers were very well thought out. They, I mean, almost to the extent of giving me kind of War Machine vibes. There were ranks on the cards, which were useful for other effects too. One of the notable things here, too, is you actually made your own deck. This was not just a deck of the tactics cards you bought and tried to fight through them. You generated your own deck of 40 cards. Mm-hmm. You can't have more than 3 cards, again, kind of like a CCG. So you could really tailor that to maximize your chance of success. I do think that was... this is a game that really leaned heavily on that, and I think this is one of the things that the game did well.
Which, interestingly enough, I definitely think that's something that like influenced future games. Like, I could see a lot of it in games like Underworlds or Aristea, where, you know, tactic card deck is an essential way of how you play. You know, and of course now we see that as a clear blending. Back then it was just like, oh, this is, I didn't see any connection. But I mean, also I was like 12.
Yeah.
Anywho. Moving along, it was definitely a mass battle game with formations of troops. So very similar to Warhammer Fantasy at the time. There were some interesting options, if I remember right, for the formations that models could come up with. I do definitely remember like cavalry moving like in a wedge. I do remember like archers had some specific formation options that were interesting as well. But it was pretty standard, you know, if you compared it to any of the other like standard rank and file games at the time, which obviously kind of sort of took some of their mechanics from the classic historical games, I guess you'd call them.
Yeah, but I mean, I think if you're going to do a mass battle game, this is part of the fantasy. You know, it's blocks of troops, so moving those troops in uniform, interesting ways, I think is kind of what you're setting yourself up to see and be excited for. And I think they did well at this too.
Yep. And then the other thing that like I think about, which was a little bit strange for me, but also like it's interesting for the time, was that when you were looking at a lot of armies that you put on the table, they made the majority of their army up of the same model, no matter which faction it was. So like starter box was whatever two factions it was. I remember the art on it being, you know, the crab clan with Hida Yakumo. But no matter really what things it said were in there of like, oh, well, yeah, you have the crab and the crane, or you have the lion and this, you basically got X amount of archers and X amount of swordsmen. And archers and swordsmen could be played in any army that was not Shadowlands or Naga. There were also only like two or three poses. So I still don't know how I feel about that. It made it really interesting because I remember back in the day, there were definitely people who talked about like, oh, you know, like, well, I started playing Crane and then I decided I didn't like it. So I went back and stripped my army, bought a character pack. And now, you know, like now I have like a dragon army. There were some units that were very specific to each clan. And I think that, you know, if the game had been out for longer, had been, you know, more releases, you would have seen a few more unique things come out. But for the most part, the majority of armies were set up with swordsmen or archers that were the generic things out of the starter box, along with a character pack, which would give you some characters, usually four from any respective clan. It was interesting. Everything was square based. The majority of things were on small bases. There were very, very few things that were on like a 40 mil or bigger. Togashi Yukuni was a large model. He would go on a 40 mil. Hida Kasada, who is also known as the Bear, was also, you know, on a 40 mil, but he's a gigantic dude. Like, he was always head and shoulders above everyone else, so it would make sense for him to be on like that larger base. But even a lot of the Shadowlands creatures and things like that were also on just the standard 25 mil or square base.
I for one am horribly disappointed that he was referred to as the Bear and not King Crab.
Yeah, there were some there was a little bit of interesting things like that, but
I do think it was, and to give listeners an idea, this next section of the notes is called Owen Has Feelings About Things. It was a fine system for its time. I, as someone that did not play it, but picked up the Daimyo edition of the rules, which, for those of you who don't know, is a compendium of the core rule book, the information presented in the clans with some small changes, and then any of the supplements, so the Shadowlands supplement, the Naga supplements, etc. Pretty much everything that's not a scenario in some of the journals is in that book. And the journals and everything else are actually up on the AEG L5R Clan War Facebook group. Link that in the show notes. So if you want to check this out, you don't have to track down the physical book. I'm a nerd for books. I like having the physical ones. I got to take a look at it. It is a charming, but in my opinion, flawed system. I don't really think of this show as doing reviews, but if I was going to review this game, I think you'd need to look at it on two lights. One is looking at it for a game of its time, and one is looking at it as a person in 2020. I think they had a lot of ideas and interesting things they wanted to try. I think some of those worked very well, like the tactics cards. I think others maybe were a little overwrought. I think where the game has problems is that it, in attempting to explain and give substance to a lot of the ideas in the setting, maybe makes things more complicated than they need to be at some points. So let me give you an example of that. So when I think mass battle game, you're talking about moving around a model that's physically got some limitations to it. But I mean, I think it's really the idea of something like a historical game, or, you know, older style Warhammer Fantasy Battle, where you're taking physical models that you put together and painted, and now you're playing a game of like Total War on the table. So all the cool things you can do in a Total War video game, you want to be able to do on the table. So like the spectacle of seeing that, you need to be able to do formations and movement well. And I think in general, the game actually does that well. But that's a lot of weight. That takes a lot of time. I think sometimes you need to maybe dial it back on a few other systems to really let that shine and enjoy that. And I think this game didn't dial it back so great. So let's talk about the initiative. So The game turn has a couple of different steps. Unlike, say, something like Warhammer Fantasy Battle, which was kind of the standard bearer for this type of game at this point in time, rather than having one player do all their stuff and then another player do all their stuff, a turn progresses and players alternate activating, or not necessarily alternate, but you activate in a initiative order. So one player will do anything at initiative step, let's say -2, and I'll get in a second to how you get there. And we just go up the chart until we get to step 12, 14, whatever the last number is. So you do your movement, you do any cavalry movement, you shoot, you fight. All that's tied to the initiative system. So it's important. But let's go through the steps of how you set up initiative for your units. First step, roll a d10. If you get a 10, you can roll another dice and either add or subtract that from your number. So beyond just potentially having a number 1 to 10, if you keep rolling 10s, you can have negative infinity or positive infinity. So generally speaking, you're going to start in the 1 to 9 region, but there can be some cases where you start going kind of crazy away from that. But okay, low probability, that's fine. Then you modify your initiative starting in the current initiative of each unit. So let's say you have a couple units that roll 1, those are going to go before that roll higher. If you have ties, there's a mechanic called the Hand of Fate that basically changes hands of players every turn, that basically just says you get to break ties if they come up. And if you have a personality or what's called a leadership package, so these are kind of like generic leaders on a unit, they can have a skill called leadership. You can modify your functional initiative up or down by the leadership value. So you start with the low ones and they decide to go up, down, not do anything. You go on through. Okay, we're getting kind of complicated, but initiative is important. But wait, there's more. After you do all that, then you start at whatever the now functional initiative is, and you can dump cards from your hand. And I mentioned earlier that these cards have ranks on them. Well, you can pick units, and you go through and dump a card, and you can use that rank number to modify your initiative even more. Okay, well, you know, cards are a limited resource. But wait, there's more. After that, your general can use his or her leadership value, and you pick one unit, and you can then modify that using, for that one unit, that high leadership score. So then you're done. So Chris, you took all this time setting up your initiative value. So how do you think you start the next phase? Like who do you think decides, what unit decides to go first in the next phase of the game?
That part I actually don't even remember.
So you might think, oh, we took all this time to set up who's going to do special action, special orders. We should probably use the initiative, but you don't, because you're not done modifying initiative yet, because now you can use special abilities that modify initiative. So you need to track all this stuff for something that really comes down to what unit goes first. And I would understand that more if that really was important, but there's so many rules and special abilities that you kind of react to things. So you can do something akin to like Overwatch from 40K, that to me, it just felt like you had all this weight, all this complication, all this added record keeping for who goes first. And it's semi-random. So like, it felt like we talked about the distinction between crunchy and clunky on the last episode. I think this falls in the clunky regime. And there's a lot of other mechanics that, to my mind, kind of fall down that distinction. They did a good job of trying to have a very legalistic rules framework. You can see the influence from the CCG design philosophy there, but you end up having a lot of distinctions that are distinctions in name only for prospective abilities that don't add a lot of value. So you've got skills, traits, abilities, something called KISO, which is like a non-USR or a universal special rule trait. So traits will be things that are keyword. So like if you have something like if you're undead, that's not something you want a skill to be able to turn off. So you need to have that in a separate bin than something like leadership, which is important. But then there's also special rules that like, well, undead's kind of a general thing. We can throw in a couple things. But if this one unit has one special thing that we also want in that bin, it just got a little kind of sprawly and confusing. And when you're talking about a game with this many models, with this many potential issues, I see that as slowing things down. And I don't see a lot of benefit. I don't see how that initiative system makes me feel more like I'm in Rokugan. I just look at that as just adding mechanical weight because that's what we came up with.
Yeah.
I can keep going. There was a lot in this game, and like I don't want to beat the game. I know you like it, and B, we're talking about a game that came out in 1998. I mean, no one benefits from me yelling at the game, but there was just a lot that I look at and just kind of go, oh, like if somebody gave you this as a playtest rule set now, there were a lot of like, oh, individual models have honor. Honor is a huge concept in the RPG and in the card game, but your army also has honor, and those use the exact same word. So at some points in the rule set, like you can usually suss it out, but it's like, oh, you just had to pick a different word. Why didn't you pick a different word? There was just a lot here that was... It really felt like an RPG. And I don't know Ken Carpenter. I looked up his work. He was previously an RPG designer. He'd done some D20 adventures. Looking at what he lists on LinkedIn as his role at AD, he also pivoted over to being an art director. This, to me, feels like something an RPG designer would have come up with. For example, you know, you look at your stat block for units. All units have 9 stats and usually 2 or 3 kisos and usually 2 or 3 skills and traits. Characters have 14 stats. Some of those end up being functionally redundant. So things like your earth stat determining how many wounds you have. Well, I've got an earth stat and also wounds. It was cool because you could take an RPG character and turn him into a clan war character for fun games, but if you're putting that in every mod, it starts adding up and feeling like this is more like a role-playing game than it is like what I think in 2021 we'd expect from a war game. So we talked a little bit about the stat blocks, how it I think linked in and felt a little bit more like an RPG. I want to be charitable. I think there's some really charming stuff here. There was a lot of really fun rules. There's a lot of really cool ideas coming from the setting. If we were going to talk about the game, the miniatures and the artwork for the game were very good for the time, or they were kind of industry for the time. The artwork is very standard. If you're familiar with like the White Wolf books from the 1990s, very much in line with like a 1990s non-Dungeons & Dragons RPG. The miniatures are very what you'd expect from the late 90s for Reaper or even like a GW. That being said, sculpting artwork has come a lot in the past 20 years, so if this is something that you're interested in, definitely take a look at miniatures. There's actually a YouTube channel unrelated to us called Dead Game Society. We'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. They do an unboxing of the original Clan War box and the minis. I say all that to say, Chris, is this a game that you would recommend?
Ugh. So that's a tough question. Essentially, I'm going to say no. If we're going with a yes or a no, I'm going to say no. Because I think, you know, going back and playing it now and having the experiences that we do with more current systems, the game doesn't quite hold up. And also, to buy 70 to 100 of these metal models, it can get a little bit rough on the wallet. And I think the hard part is that, you know, the universe for this game is absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I do highly recommend going out and buying the books. I mean, like, you can get them for like $2, $3 a piece sometimes at like Barnes and Noble. Like, they were just small books. The original Clan War series is 7. There's one for each clan. Like, and it follows one story. And the lion one is only half about the lion, so it makes it just even better. But with that being said, I think there's some more interesting ways to kind of explore that, unfortunately, than going back and picking up Clan War. I do know that right now there's a fan-made creation that adapts Test of Honor rules for Clan War, which is very interesting. I haven't really dabbled in it too much. I've managed to kind of hold off on it for now. We'll see how that works out. It's been in the back of my head for a little bit now. It's done in a pretty interesting way. The Test of Honor or models aren't bad, and there are some like neat 3D print options for some of these things, and also some of those Privateer Press loot crate options are awesome models. They're definitely like the newer Togashi Yukuni that they had was just super sweet, and would definitely be a cool kind of way to do that. If you're looking for something also like that's just in a very similar kind of feel in universe, you know, you could definitely give Bushido a try,
mm-hmm.
which is a fun skirmish game with a little bit more modern rules. And sometimes you can, like, you see a lot of people who will do nods to L5R. Like, personally, I play Prefecture, which is a lot of samurai stuff, and I have it painted up just like Dragon Clan. But for me, you know, like, that gets me a lot of the same kind of, like, I still get to connect with that universe without, like, necessarily buying and painting this and storing, you know, this amount of models. And I think lastly with it too is, unfortunately, unlike a lot of the dead games that we've talked about before, there are a lot of, like, large barriers to entry with this right now. One being that the playgroup that I've seen for Clan War is a little bit smaller than some of the things that we've talked before with, like, Confrontation or AT43 or Eden or Guild Ball and Dark Age. You know, all these games, like, do have a pretty fanatical fan base that is still pretty active.
Mm-hmm.
Even during the pandemic, because there's still been, like, tabletop simulator versions or, you know, things coming up. There really hasn't been that from what I've seen from Clan War. It seems like a lot of the people who are interested in that universe in the game are exploring the other options for games to play, like either Test of Honor or the Emerald Empire version of Test of Honor. And just, again, you know, the very large cost to buying, you know, a lot of models for a game that, unfortunately, you might not be able to get that many games in of.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually asked you this. Are you generally a fan of rank and flank mass battle systems?
You definitely haven't asked me that on a podcast before. I think we've hinted on it once or twice when we talked about Conquest. But in general, I don't particularly enjoy games that use models as wound counters.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've felt that way with playing out a few of those games that, as you're playing, it felt less that you were playing an army game, and it felt more like you were playing a skirmish game with, like, models that are on, like, just gigantic square bases that, you know, have built-in wound counters. You just pick up each one for each time you take a wound, and, you know, that combined with, like, some of the movement mechanics and stuff like that, it's stuff I enjoyed more of in back in the day. Like, I did play Warhammer Fantasy 5th edition, 6th edition, and had fun with it, but it most likely really wouldn't be the type of game that, like, I reach for first nowadays. Comes to games that, like, I get really excited about to put on the table, it's typically ones that have less models, or have less models that, you know, generally do more. You're typically just not losing a model before it does anything. That usually has, like, more of a cinematic feel on the table, with usually more terrain. More terrain is a big thing. And I also like a smaller table size, you know.
Yeah.
Being in a small apartment, you know, 2x2 is a magical and wonderful size for me. Like, 3x3 is doable. 4x4 is a challenge. 4x6 or 4x8 is impossible. Like,
it's right out.
Yeah, it is. It's just like, how big is a bed? maybe that will work. Like,
I mean, Chris, for all we know, we're the weirdos. You know, we don't carry around every bit and bob on our back on a backpack, and we don't just randomly have 4-foot by 8-foot dinner tables. I mean, who knows? Maybe we're the weirdos. I am probably more of a mass battle game fan than you. I apologize. I did ask you that. I forgot that we had had the conversation. I like the spectacle. I liked Warhammer Fantasy Battle probably more than I like Age of Sigmar. I think Age of Sigmar is a fine game. I, generally speaking, just like that spectacle. I like the kind of Total War style. We're going to run blocks at each other, and that's just fun. I totally get that's not for everyone. The market kind of plays that out. I'm not opposed to playing a game like Clan War, but I'm with you. To me, I think it's a little bit more attractive to go like the Emerald Empire mod of Test of Honor than it is to dive into this. I can see a couple situations where I would be tempted to play a game of Clan War, though. So one of them being if, let's say, hypothetically, we started doing a L5R RPG session, and the capstone of that was going to be a large-scale battle. It's kind of hard to do with RPG rules. I can definitely see this being like a really fun way to cap off a game. I don't know that I have it in me to paint another 100 models for a game that I'm probably not going to play that often, that takes this much time to play. I'm with Chris. If I'm going to dive into something like this, I'm going to either pick up some new 3D printed option stuff for line troopers, or go to the Privateer Press, loot crate offerings. There was a line of minis for the L5R RPG by a company called Valiant. They're a little more recent Clan War ones that were just, you know, take advantage of the improvements in casting in the time period since the game that look beautiful. I don't know that I'd run out and buy a bunch of the old metal. And just on a more personal note, I actually know a store in Connecticut that carries some of the old Clan War L5R metal. I've bought some models from them for myself. The models themselves have not been old. Well, there's some definite lead rot on the models I've gotten. So just one thing to keep in mind from this vintage of models.
I think that's a pretty fair take on it.
Yeah, it sucks, but it is what it is. Again, not dogging the game, just I don't know that this is going to be the new Dark Age or confrontation for us.
Well, I mean, like, for people who haven't checked out our Discord yet, you know, we've already gotten a bunch of comments, essentially, of like, oh man, you know, like, you guys just, like, keep getting us into game, you know, like, it's too tempting, I keep getting into things. It's like, man, you know what, like, you know how I feel? Like, you know how many models I've gotten since we started this podcast? Like, man, I don't want to hear it, but,
Do you know how badly Chris and I enable each other? Do you see how we suffer for you?
You know, like, before this started, you know, I definitely did not have Confrontation or AT-43.
Yep.
Oof. But I do think, you know, like, every so often, and that's not it, you know, like, every so often, you know, like, I think we're gonna hit a game where, as much as, you know, like, it was really cool for its time, as much as we enjoyed it in the day, you know, or as much as we enjoyed, like, the universe and stuff, you know, we might not want to play it now. But, I mean, that's true of, like, a lot of things. Man, there's definitely, like, video games where you go back, it's like, oh, man, this was super cool in the day, you know, and it's, you don't want to go back and play it now. Like, you know, like, there's definitely some stuff where it was, like, super cool, and then it's like, yeah, you know, I could play this, or, you know, I could spend my time doing something else that I want
to
do.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I have a lot of old video games. I was lucky that my dad loved computer coding when I was young. Things like an Atari ST. I think I still have that in the basement somewhere. So I played the original Rogue. You've probably heard of roguelikes. I played Rogue as a kid. It was a fine game, but there were a lot of technology limitations that led to design decisions that I think there have been interesting riffs on those recently. So, like, one of my more recent favorite roguelikes, Dead Cells, does something really interesting with the no-save mechanic. The original Rogue did not do anything interesting. You could not save your game. The end. I don't know that I want to invest a lot of time into that these days. So, yeah, I think as games progress and change, I think people are always going to have favorites and feel nostalgic for certain aspects of these older games, but I think particularly for tabletop wargaming, there have been pretty much straight up improvements over the past 20, 25 years. I mean, I think casting, painting, even kind of some of the commonplace conventions for how people play games all have come a very long way since Limp Bizkit was on the radio.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, man, you know, lots of people listen to Limp Bizkit back in the 2000s. How many people, right? Is that the thing that you're listening to when you get into your car to go to work now? You know, I would be super interested if someone eventually decides to do a new take on it.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, I think it would be one of the most radical things going forward. It would not be a simple, like, oh, yeah, we did this, and now there's new models, and we're still going to put out a mass battle game. Like, you know, like, I could definitely see a smaller style kind of skirmish system coming out, which would be pretty cool. I would definitely like to see more stuff like Privateer did with, you know, creating some of those models for just, like, kind of, like, big characters, like, classic characters.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. If Privateer did L5R Machine, I would definitely give that a very hard look.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah, like, that's it. It's like, man, even if they just released, like, hey, man, we have these, like, 12 models out. We're going to release a simple rule set where you can just duel with the models and be like, all right, like, rock and roll. I'm going to go find all of them now.
Yep.
Oh man, that'd be so cool. Just Hita Kasada versus like Togashi Ikuni would be just awesome. I'd be so happy. And that's it. Yeah, I mean, like, we could go on, like, I could go on and on about, like, all the super cool, like, very cinematic, like, things that happened. I mean, anywho, so this was a lot of fun. Hope you guys enjoy. And for now, this is Chris.
This is Owen.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Intro music is Axe to Mouth by Pulp 45, which is Owen's old band. Outro music is Control My Fate by Ataraxia, which is Chris's old band. All songs used with permission. If you like what you hear, please like or subscribe. Thanks.
The Tutori saga is essentially the Sky, like the worst parts of the Skywalker thing, where it's like this guy managed to ruin everything for everyone. and like 75% of his kids are terrible. Like
I'm just imagining him meeting Fu Leng now, going, "Hello there."
Stop! Oh my god! How do you confuse Skywalker with Kenobi? You're killing me. That's gonna get us even. That's gonna be the hate mail thing now. I was wrong. For all of our Star Wars fans, you know that
I know a Star Wars.
Anyway. Might punch you. This is this. I might punch you. This is my.